KZSU FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I am an assistant professor of law at the Charlotte School of Law in Charlotte, North Carolina, and a non-resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture, and today we dive back into issues involving privacy and data collection by governments, an area of increasing importance and increasing concern among a wide variety of people, not just in the technology world, but also privacy advocates and consumers and citizens generally. An extremely important issue, and I'm very excited to have on the show one of the editors of a fascinating new volume called Profiling the European Citizen, Cross-Disciplinary Perspectives. The publisher is Springer, and the editor and author of several pieces in the book is Murray Hildebrandt. Murray is one of the editors. Serge Gutworth, the other editor, is not joining us today. But for purposes of our discussion, I will refer to this book as Murray's book, Profiling the European Citizen, Cross-Disciplinary Perspectives. The title of the book suggests the topic, and this is a book which I think is of inestimable value to anyone thinking about the data mining and data aggregation efforts and goals of not just governments generally, but really of any organization that is seeking to gather data for purposes of figuring out who their consumers are, who their citizens are, who their customers are, and so forth. Profiling the European Citizen brings together a variety of European scholars discussing this issue in relation to EU's policies and EU's mores and the kind of technology that exists and is being used by governments in Europe. And in our conversation today, we're going to be talking about what profiling is and some of the major concerns that are coming out of the scholarly community and the government community in the EU regarding the issue of profiling. Again, this is an issue which is becoming of increasing importance, especially as the United States gathers more and more information about citizens, and the Department of Justice operates fusion centers that attempt to do data aggregation on frankly, who knows who, and a variety of other private technologies and private companies like ChoicePoint that bring together data on customers and so forth. So this is an issue that, while we're going to be focusing on the EU, which is obviously an excellent crucible to study these issues, should be, I think, of significant concern to anyone that lives in a country that has a government. So by that I mean really to all of us, because this is certainly where we're heading with the technology and something that needs to be discussed. And in Profiling the European Citizen, Murray and her co-authors bring together a variety of research looking at various aspects that go into what we call profiling. I'm going to ask Murray about her background in more detail, but by way of brief background before we start our discussion, Murray got her law degree from Leiden University in the Netherlands and did her PhD thesis in philosophy of criminal law at the Erasmus School of Law in Rotterdam, integrating, interestingly, legal anthropology and legal history to develop a hermeneutic phenomenology of punishment. So this is someone who has a deep understanding of some of the issues that go into what we do with this data, what we do with profiling. Since 2002, she's been seconded as a senior researcher to the Law Society of Technology and Society at Free University Brussels, and she's working on a 5-year research project that she co-authored on law and autonomic computing, mutual transformations. She also, as a coordinator of profiling within the EU-funded network on the future of identity and information society, known as FITIS, and she's been working on the implications of emerging technologies like ambient intelligence, which is something else we're going to talk about today, for central tenets of democracy and the rule of law. So with that introduction, Murray, thank you for joining us in Hearsay Culture, and thank you for calling in from Europe.
Thank you very much. Thanks very much, David, for reaching across the ocean.
This is certainly one of my goals, and I look forward to having more guests on from the EU and from other points in the world to get a more holistic view of what we're doing with technology today across the globe. I mentioned in the introduction your brief biography, but I do want to start off, as I do with my authors, to talk a little bit more about your background and ask you how you got into focusing on these issues.
Yes, well, like you say, basically I started my academic education as a lawyer and then got philosophy of criminal law. But before that, I actually had a brief period during which I studied cultural anthropology. I was married to somebody from Goa in India, that old Portuguese India, where I lived for some time. And what has stayed with me from that period quite some time ago is a comparative perspective, an interest in reaching across oceans and other things. And when you look at the subject of profiling, then I think to really get a grasp of what is at stake here, you must have some interdisciplinary interests. And what basically happened is that after doing my PhD in criminal, philosophy of criminal law, I was converted from the Erasmus School of Law in Rotterdam to the Center of Science, Law, Science, Technology and Society Studies at the Vrije Universiteit in Brussels, which tries to integrate some of the perspectives of the Science, Technology and Society Studies. We've been working, for instance, with Bruno Latour in Paris and Isabel Stengert, trying to bring in some of these perspectives into the study of law, and especially the study of emerging technologies and emerging social technical infrastructures in relation to law. Like you mentioned, the project that we're working on at this moment, it's a project of what IBM has coined autonomic computing, which is a very interesting term. Maybe we can get back to that later. And what we basically try to do is to see how these kind of emerging and future technologies, which means that they will come on the market in 1 year or after 5 years, what are the implications of these technologies for, let's say, the legal framework that we live with. So we are not primarily interested in waiting until these technologies have taken over practically and then sort of adapting some legal rules in order to be able to cope with them. But we're rather looking at sort of the new social technical infrastructure that is emerging, that for instance the European Union, but also a lot of business enterprises investing in, like for instance ambient intelligence, autonomous computing, etc. What are the implications for constitutional democracy, for the rule of law? How does this impact privacy, and does it mean that we have to perhaps rethink privacy in a time when your data are basically everywhere and they can be correlated and connected with each other, meaning that new types of knowledge emerge from these data? So the point of what we're doing is not to look only at black letter law and how we can adapt that to technologies once we're there, but we're trying to anticipate what could be consequences.
The book, as I mentioned, brings together a number of scholars writing in this area. Perhaps you could talk a bit more about the range of contributors to Profile of the European Citizen.
Yes, this is what makes the book, we think, very interesting. From LSTF, World Science, Technology and Society in Brussels, we're involved in a number of European financed projects, financed by the European Commission. And this book is basically the result of a consortium of research institutes. The consortium is called FIWIS, the Future of Information, the Future of Identity and Information Society. We have 34 partners across Europe, and the most interesting thing is that this consortium is really multidisciplinary. So we're trying to look at identification technologies, emerging identification technologies from the perspective of law, looking at social aspects and, of course, computer science aspects, and trying to start communicating about these technologies from these different perspectives. So what we're not trying to do is to write from your own perspective and then put it together, because that's not going to bring very much news, but to reach across and try to understand the language of the other discipline. And we've been writing a set of reports within that consortium about profiling technologies. And at a certain point, we thought it would be interesting to generate these reports for the academic community to turn it into a book, not only for the academic community, but also for policymakers and NGOs, business enterprise, also citizens. And we have chosen a particular format for that, inviting 15 main authors who write a piece from their own disciplinary perspective, so it can be law, it can be computer science, which means that we begin to look from a technical perspective at what profiling actually is. I think we'll come back to that. And we'll then look at it from another perspective, which are the implications, which problems are raised by these technologies, and also always looking at a social perspective, realizing that these perspectives are not separate in reality. And we have asked for every main author, so for every text, we have invited authors within the consortium from another particular perspective to write a reply. Now, of course, in an academic world, replies are usually meant to be critical. You want to sort of deconstruct the arguments that your peer, your colleague is making. But the idea of this book is that you present a perspective of what you have just read in the main text from your own disciplinary perspective. So you sort of enlarge the perspective on the subjects that we're talking about. So we have a chapter on the role of algorithms, that's computer techniques, in the process of profiling, and we have invited a mathematician, actually a philosopher of mathematics, to look at that chapter from the perspective of mathematics. Hmm. And at that same chapter, we invited computer scientists to provide a reply talking about privacy preserving data mining, and to look at how you can integrate privacy-enhancing technologies into the algorithms that you use for data mining. Now, that's the idea of this big volume, which means that in the end we had 30 authors collaborating in this project, and we are actually very proud of it. We think it provides kind of a telescopic perspective on profiling, on the implications, and basically it tries to set the agenda for further research, because in the field of ICT and privacy, most people focus on data instead of on the results of data mining, which is these profiles. Sometimes it seems that because it is easier to talk about data and it's easier to detect and to locate data, that people are not interested to look at what is happening basically behind their back, and that is the generation of all these profiles that can be applied to you.
And that perhaps just to jump in, Ray, because I think you're going where I would like to go, which is really defining this term profiling, because we certainly hear this term and, you know, we read about it increasingly, although it's still, I wouldn't say a prevalent term, but we see it in the press. What is the definition of profiling that you are building this book around, and then how does it apply to EU?
The way we use the term profiling here is, of course, concerns automated profiling. And the term used in the literature for this is KDD. KDD stands for Knowledge Discovery in databases. We were then returned because it requested the fact that we're talking about the construction of knowledge, not just data, actually not just information, but knowledge, but that this knowledge is mined from large databases, collections of data. The process of constructing the knowledge starts with, of course, the collection of data from an environment. And that means that you have to always start with the translation of real-life events, driving a car, walking through a room, moving your hand, whatever, into machine-readable data. That's always the first step. And in an online environment where everything is machine-readable, this is, of course, very easy. The second step is to aggregate these data into databases and to prepare the data in order to be analyzed. And that means computer specialists talk about data cleansing and data preparation. It basically means that you structure the data in a way that makes it easier to search them and to mine them. The third step is the mining of data. What we mean, mining of data, means that you perform certain mathematical steps, certain computer techniques, software programs on this database, and that you make this program find patterns in the data. You could say that profiling is the same as pattern recognition. These patterns that you find in data don't have to be interpreted. You have to see what they mean, whether they are useful for your business, for instance, or think of criminal justice investigations, whether these patterns provide you information or knowledge about potential suspects. And after that has been done, you are going to apply these patterns to new data. And that will also give you a look back to the initial state because it means you can test the patterns and you can also refine them. So this is basically what profiling is about. It's about both the construction of profiles and the application of profiles. And there are some other very important distinctions to be made when we talk about profiling. Apart from the fact that it defines the both construction and application of profiles, it's important to discriminate between an individual profile and a group profile. If I want an individual profile of somebody, I take that person's data and put them in a database and mine them, so I look for patterns in that person's data. To take an example of what is called behavioral biometric profiling, if I sit behind my computer and I type, then this is called keystroke behavior. And I remember at some point that when I was working behind my computer and online, that I think Microsoft asked me, because I had protection on my computer, asked me whether I minded that they were measuring my keystroke behavior. So that means when you're online, anybody who can peek into your computer can check on your keystroke behavior, and they can find patterns in that, and that obviously means that they can re-recognize you when you go online. It means that they don't know your name, they don't know who you are, probably not interested. But because you have this specific pattern of keystroke behavior, you can be re-recognized. And if you can link that sort of information to your surfing behavior online, that basically means you don't even need an IP address or your name or whatever to re-recognize you if you make quite a profile of you. Now, this is an individual profile made of the data of one person. What's very interesting and very important is the construction of group profiles. It means that you have a data set with data of a whole lot of people, talk about thousands, hundreds of thousands of people. You mine these data for patterns and you get from these data good patterns. Just to give you an example, may sound a bit silly, but the type of patterns or correlations that you can find in these databases, by these profiles, is, for instance, that all people with blue eyes and short legs have a chance of 56% to contract a certain type of cancer before the age of 67. Once again, this is a bit of a silly example.
Right.
But I will explain what point I try to make. This is a good profile. So you say, okay, I mine these data, and this is the pattern that emerged. You would not have thought of that before, so it is novel knowledge. It's not that you start with a hypothesis that you then check. You sort of allow your software to mine knowledge that you didn't even know you didn't know, as Carl Norske, for instance, said. Now, if you have a profile that says, and I'm going to simplify the example, that says that all people with blue eyes have a chance of 56% to contract a specific disease before a specific age, then this is a good profile, probably in the sense that it is correct for the group as a whole, but it doesn't mean that that percentage applies to every member of the group. It's an average percentage. And if you want to know the percentage that is applicable to every single person with blue eyes, then you have to take into account a lot of other factors like gender, age, educational background, earning capacity, lifestyle, smoking, etc. The interesting thing is that what is done with good profiles is that they are applied at a certain point to a specific person. Think of, for instance, credit rating profiling. Think of an organization like Experian, which is a very beautiful example of an organization, a private organization, commercial organization, that also does a profiling. By these profiling technologies that they use, they sort of categorize consumers or people that want to have a credit into different categories. And this allows them to provide a credit rating for a certain person. And I will give you an example. There was somebody who wanted to order a subscription to a mobile phone company. And this is somebody who always paid his bills and never had any serious problems financially. And he was refused. And he called the telephone company. And they said, well, sorry, but we have asked Experian, these credit rating companies, and they have said you're high risk. So you can call them, but they don't want to do business with you. So he called Experian, and he inquired why he had a high risk. And they said to him, well, you fall into the category of people with a high risk, because of a set of criteria, which were actually relatively low, like he had at a certain point made several requests in a very brief time online for new subscriptions and some other rather trivial data. But due to these trivial data, his data matched a group profile which was considered high risk. And so he told Experian, said, this is ridiculous. And he said, well, this is not the point. We have this profile here, and on the basis of your data, matching the profile, we tell our client that you are a high risk. And the decision not to give you credit is not ours, that's of the other company.
Amazing.
This is a nice example because it gives you a lot of the implications of the use of profiling technologies, especially in the case that group profiles are in the end applied to individuals whose data they match. You see issues of due process here because if something like this happens to me and I call a company and they give me some vague story, I'm never going to find out the basis of which I was assumed, meaning through society. If a company doesn't want to contact with me, I basically can't sue that company. So if they're not going to tell me why they decided that, I can't contest that decision. So this is an issue of due process.
Right.
In many ways, these types of applications of profile, group profile, that is being mined from other people's data and then are applied to you when they match your data. And of course also privacy issue at stake because
Murray, before we get into privacy, before we get into privacy, I actually do want to take a quick break. You've covered a wide variety of ground, which is great, and I do want to focus in on a couple of those points in a moment. But we are talking to Murray Hildebrandt, editor and contributor to the book Profile in the European Citizen, Cross-Disciplinary Perspectives, published by Springer. For those of you that listen to Hearsay Culture regularly, you know that Hearsay Culture is on KZSU-FM, and KZSU is a non-profit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that relies on donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways that you can make a donation to KZSU. First, you can go to our website at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. Or alternatively, you can go to an email, underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, that's underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu, and make a donation. Regardless of whether you listen to the show by way of podcast or through the Center for Internet Society's webpage, or if you listen to the show through hearsayculture.com, I do hope you'll consider making a donation to KZSU FM Stanford, because it relies on those donations, and it is the home of Hearsay Culture. So thank you, and I hope you consider doing it. Murray, I interrupted you, and I do want to drill down on a couple of these points that you mentioned. You know, and I agree with you that your Experian example, I think, is very useful, especially for those that aren't familiar with this technology and how it's used to see some of its implications. And I do want to talk about a couple of those. One of the terms that you used in the beginning of the discussion, one that I want to focus on, is this idea of ambient intelligence. And you write in the book, AMI, the acronym for it, environments may know your preferences long before you became aware of them and adapt themselves in order to meet those preferences. Anyone that reads any form of science fiction, whether it's Aldous Huxley or otherwise, may read this statement and think, my God, we've entered now science fiction. So what is AMI?
Yes, AMI is basically a vision of ambient intelligence. It's a vision that has been propagated as such by the European Commission. Of course, by Philips, they are the two, I think, who coined the term. Basically, it is what has been referred to for a long time in the United States as pervasive, ubiquitous computing. IBM is calling it autonomic computing. These terms don't all refer to the same, but basically highlight different dimensions. But the idea of ambient intelligence is basically that the offline world is turned online, as it has been worded by the ITU in its report on the Internet of Things, which I think is a beautiful metaphor for ambient intelligence. Ambient intelligence, the Internet of Things, basically means that every thing in our environment, so the bookcase, the desk, your car, your underwear, the paintings, the walls, the curtains, the windows, all are tagged. They have an RFID tag, which means that they can wirelessly communicate. At the same time, your environment is provided with sensor technology that can sense temperature, movement, light, etc. Now, all these sensor technologies and RFID tags sort of transmit all events in your plant world into machine-readable data that go online. And you can just imagine what kind of enormous databases it will provide. And these databases can then be mined for patterns, as I have tried to explain before. And the driver behind AD intelligence is basically different enterprises like Philips, who have this wonderful narrative, as somebody calls it, saying that AD intelligence is going to be a user-centric social-technical infrastructure. The idea is, and I take this from IBM's website on autonomic computing, because I think, again, this is a wonderful metaphor. IBM says, okay, your autonomic nervous system is not going to ask you all the time whether your temperature has to be raised, whether your heartbeat has to be slowed down. These sort of questions it's never going to ask you. It's going to regulate your physical state, your biological status, in a way that you don't ever have conscious access to. It will simply take care of you. And what IBM says is now, we are going to take care that your physical environment is going to do the same thing for you. So the idea is that we no longer have keyboards and maybe not even computer screens, but that the complexity of this technical infrastructure that is going to anticipate your needs and desires, that this complexity is behind the sources of your environment. So think again of sensor technologies, etc. To give you again an example of keystroke behavior, imagine if I'm sitting down to work on my computer, I have a certain typing rhythm, and the software detects at which point I'm going to walk into the kitchen and make some coffee. This is a very trivial example, of course. But at a certain point, the environment that would be entirely interconnected will, from my type of behavior or from any other type of behavior that I have, will guess that I'm ready for coffee. So by the time I get up to get the coffee, it will already be there. Once again, you can say that it is trivial. You can say also, of course, that it is very creepy, but it's a very interesting technology. It would mean that that your environment anticipates what you would want on the basis of this group profiling, perhaps also some individual profiling, but I think most of it will be a matter of group profiling. So on the basis of mining all these data and matching your data with group profiles, the environment, the computerized, interconnected, autonomic environment will infer which are your preferences. And on that basis, we need to cater to you.
Now, Murray, I do want to ask you, as we think about these issues, and I want to discuss really some of the philosophical concerns with respect to AMI environments. Before we get to that, how prevalent is profiling in the EU? I mentioned fusion centers here in the United States, but I'm curious, how prevalent is the use of profiling? Put aside for the moment private entities. I'm more interested in governments. How much, if you can tell, profiling is going on?
That's a very difficult question. I think that private agent guard is much further into profiling than governments at this moment. Of course, the most interesting and most threatening development there seems to be forensic profiling, way to sort of predict terrorist attacks or to well, you know the film The Matrix. Sorry, the term Minority Report, I think that's a good example. The idea is that sort of predict who at which point is going to commit a criminal offense. And that long before that person is going to do it, you can detain that person and prevent that he's going to do it. Now, I must say, this is obviously science fiction, but I'm also sure that in the forensic field, the idea of using databases for this purpose is being discovered at this moment, and it's also being developed. But as you probably know, in Europe we have quite a lot of legislation, which data protection legislation at the European level, which is transposed into national law in the member states, that basically prevents linking different databases, because in principle data that has been collected for a certain purpose cannot be used for another purpose without consent of the person whose data are concerned. And I think that this legislation is at this moment still reasonably effective in preventing the kind of fusion that you are talking about in the United States. I think in the United States it's easier also for governments to get hold of data that have been collected in the private sector. I think that is in Europe also more difficult, precisely because of the fact that if you consent to give your personal data, that this consent only concerns the purpose for which they have been collected. And secondly, using principle is problematic, let's put it that way.
It's, you know, it's an interesting contrast, because certainly from a myopic perspective, the United States prides itself on defending individual liberties and protecting those in the law, and yet, at least in my read of the situation, it does seem like there's at least more regulation of this the use of this data in the EU than we've seen thus far in the United States, which kind of leads to, you know, the follow-up question, which is the effectiveness of the legislation. I mean, we definitely, as we know, can write detailed regulations with multi-part steps and balancing that needs to be done in the law. But at the end of the day, if the laws are being enforced, or if there are significant loopholes, or in fact that the law cannot control the activity, as Larry Lessig and others have written about, then the law isn't doing as effective a job as it could. And you write about this in your piece. To the extent that the regulations do exist, how effective are they in controlling the, as you put it, scarier potential uses of data mining?
Yes, this is a very important question, and I immediately refer to a report written by Christopher Fenn of the Knowledge of Economics, in which he compares the anti-terrorist measures taken in the United States with those taken in the European Union, also with regard to privacy, of course, data protection. And his conclusion was, I think the report is now 3 years old, that because of the strength of the civil society in the United States, the measures taken across the ocean from my point of view, in the end, are always thrown down. Now, in Europe, we think we have this wonderful legislator. We have these documents that they care about. So, because we have written the protections down, particularly in data protection directives that I would like to say something about, we think that we're safe, which in fact means that in the end, we may seem to be less protected than the United States. The problem with data protection directive is twofold. First, it focuses on personal data. And the directive basically derives from what we call the Fair Information Principles, which actually go back to the Privacy Act 1973 in the United States and the OECD Guidelines 1981. The Fair Information Principles, which grant certain rights to individuals with respect to their personal data and certain obligations for, let's call them, data controllers, the organizations that determine the purpose of the data that are collected and that give the assignment for the data presenters to collect the data. So the Fair Information Principles are meant to provide transparency for citizens and to give certain obligations to private enterprise and for governments to in their way of dealing with personal data. The Data Protection Directive in the European Union, one must always remember that the first objective of that directive is to prevent obstructions of the internal economic market. So the first objective is to enable the free flow of information between the member states. Now, interestingly, if you have a constitutional democracy, the way you are instrumental in creating this free flow must be a way in which you build your protections. So, this is what the Data Protection Directive is about. It allows the free flow of information, but it has built-in protections that restrict the free flow of information. The directive is basically entirely tuned to personal data, and that is what basically the problem with profiles, because group profiles are not personal data. They are probably mined from other people's data. So, on the one hand, you want to protect your personal data. Perhaps you want to minimize the personal data that you give out. But if you look at social technical infrastructures like agent intelligence and at smart applications, which are basically a kind of preliminary of this smart infrastructure, then what you want is to protect yourself against unwanted application of these group profiles. And this protection is problematic within the directive. I would like to say something about that, perhaps if we have time. But here we're referring to Laura Blessing, and then I want to refer to the second problem with the directive, mm-hmm. and with actually any data protection legislation, and then the fact that you can write down all sorts of rights and obligations. But basically, you are then using the technology of the script and the printed press. So the law is entirely entwined with the script, with writing. You are using that technology to try to control this new infrastructure. And we all know that the fact that I have a right to know which organization holds my data and what is doing with my data. But to exercise that right is practically impossible. So, in fact, I don't know what is happening because I don't have the technological means to see what is happening. The directive gives me the right in Article 15 not to be subject to automated decisions that have a serious impact on me or that have legal consequence. Now, how do I know that such decisions, for instance, about credit rating, if I order something and the company refuses on the basis of having contact with Experian and maybe there is some bad match between my data and some good profile, I refer to the example I gave. If I don't know what's happening to my data, if I don't know which group profiles match with my data, then basically I cannot protect myself against it, and I also cannot, Article 15 doesn't give me very much. Mm-hmm. Now, Article 15 is coupled in the Data Protection Directive by Article 12, which gives you a right of access to the logic of the setting, especially in cases like Article 50. So it would mean that if an autonomic decision is taken with regard to the automated decision, then I have a right to go to the organization to say I want to know the logic of processing behind those decisions. And again, on paper this sounds very nice, but in practice what does it mean? Are they going to give me the algorithms by which they have mined databases and constructed good profiles? Well, I'm one of the computer scientists, so it's not going to help me at all.
Mm-hmm.
And the first problem, even before I can ask for the information, is that I don't know which decisions are taken with regard to me. I have absolutely no idea which profiles, good profiles, constructed out of other people's data, are going to match at some point with my profile, with my data, and because I don't know that, I also don't know what are the possible implications. But I think this is a very important problem, and I agree with Lessing to the extent that we are sort of using the technology of the script, and I'm thinking of the law now,
right,
to provide protection in a totally different social-technical infrastructure. And I don't always agree with Lessing's solutions, because I think that what we would basically need to do is to rethink how we want to articulate legal rules, whether it will be sufficient to articulate them on paper, and so the legislator writes down the rule on paper and enacts it from that moment onwards. It's enforced, but in practice, within this social technical infrastructure, because you have no idea what's happening, you cannot exercise the rights.
The book is Profiling the European Citizen. The editor and contributor, one of the editors and our guest today, Murray Hildebrandt. Murray, we have about 5 or so minutes left, and so obviously in a show like this we can only touch the tip of the iceberg, and there's a variety of questions I could ask, but I do want to ask you this question, which I think ties this issue together, and one that you alluded to earlier, which are the fundamental questions of privacy. And this is something that has been written about fairly extensively in the United States, the questions of what we do and what privacy rights we ultimately have with the uses of technology. And profiling, of course, is potentially a direct conflict of that, and I think, again, your Experian example is a good one. You know, my question really is this, and recognizing, of course, it's a question that can't be answered adequately in the remaining time, so maybe in a 2 or 3 minute overview, you know, the basic question, I think, is, can privacy be protected in this environment? We know the limitations of law. We know the abilities of the architecture to create the ability to do profiling, and we know about the norms and the markets that exist. Of course, I'm now again borrowing from Larry Lessig's work in Code. What can we ultimately protect the individual's privacy in an ambient, intelligent data mining world?
That's a great question for the last couple of minutes.
Exactly. It's an unfair question, I recognize, in the time we have.
Yes, of course. Yeah. Important question. First, I think we have to rethink privacy. Privacy has been seen in the past when it was invented, sort of, as the right to be left alone, so not associated with secrecy and isolation. I think it's very important to develop, or let me say, further develop a relational concept of privacy. I refer to the working definition of Adler and Rosenberg. The right to privacy is a freedom from unreasonable constraints of the construction of your identity. So privacy is not only retreating from the rest of the world, but it is negotiating the boundaries with the rest of the world. And this is where technology could actually play a very important role. It allows you to negotiate borders between yourself and your socio-technical environment. So I'm also very optimistic about qualifying technology. Before people think, the listeners think that I'm against them, I'm not. I think we're in an age of information overload. And I think that qualifying technologies are the only technology so far that will allow us to discriminate between what data are information and what data are noise. The point is that we have to develop the technologies that allow us to exercise the right to privacy, and we have to rethink that right to privacy. I already mentioned that it's important to see privacy as something relational, and I also like to refer to people like Helen Musselbaum and others who talk about contextual privacy, who talk about privacy in public. The technological infrastructure has sort of conflated the public and the private sphere. We can feel very sorry about that, but we can also say this gives a lot of opportunities to defend, if we design the right type of technologies, our privacy also in a public environment, in an offline environment, but also when this offline world is turned online, to be able to negotiate, for instance, via your personal digital assistant, which data you are going to get. And the point of this book and the point of a lot of my other work is that to be able to exercise the right to privacy, to be able to decide which data you want to hide at what moment, because that will differ per situation and for no one, you need to know what profiles are around. So in the community of computer scientists, you have those that propagate PETs, privacy enhancing technologies, that are basically anonymizers and all of our technologies hiding, minimizing your data, or the exchange of your data. Now, I'm interested in transparency enhancing technologies that allow you to get a feel of what group profiles are around that are going to match with your profile, with your data, and how this is going to impact you. And I'm convinced that if lawyers and computer scientists and people with perspective from the social sciences and social theory are going to continue talking about these things together, then it will be very well possible to integrate protection into the technical infrastructure that we have been discussing in this hour. And that means we would basically do what Montesquieu thought of quite some time ago now, because he invented the idea, let's also talk about lockdown, but he coined the idea that sometimes you need the authority of the state to defend yourself against the state. And what I'm saying now is sometimes you need to use the social technical infrastructure against which you want to protect yourself, to protect yourself. So you have to build into the infrastructure certain prohibitions at the level of the hardware and the software. And I am, in principle, optimistic that this is possible.
Murray, I do need to, on that abrupt note, end on that optimistic note, because we are out of time, and of course, in a show like this, I mean, it's an obvious time for me to certainly invite you back to discuss these issues, because there's far more to discuss than we have in an hour-long radio show. I know that you have a page on BE Press, and so for those that want to learn more about you and your work, is the BE Press page would be the best place to go? Is that correct?
Sorry, Yes. I would be Deepa's page, but I would refer to those some text on it and reference it to other websites.
Terrific. The author and editor, one of the editors, is Murray Hildebrandt, the guest today, editor of the book Profiling the European Citizen, Cross-Disciplinary Perspectives. Murray, is a fascinating discussion, and I think you've given my listeners a lot of areas for thought, and as well as, I think, a healthy view of the positive aspects of profiling, despite what seem to be and what is often right about is their more pernicious connotations. So thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture. I look forward to talking again in the future.
Okay, thank you very much for the invitation. Okay,
bye-bye. Bye, thank you. We are going to have a number of guests coming up on Hearsay Culture discussing these issues, and for those people that want to check out that schedule, please go to hearsayculture.com and click on the schedule link. As always, you can listen to this show by going to the iTunes webpage for Hearsay Culture, which is actually found through the Stanford Center for Internet Society's page of iTunes. You can pick up the RSS feed at the CIS's webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu, and you can always get the show at hearsayculture.com. Please email me with any suggestions, thoughts, comments, feedback at dave@hearsayculture.com. And otherwise, I thank you for listening to the show today. I hope you've enjoyed the conversation. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming. Have a great day.